So imagine you build this machine learning model, right? And you want it to predict house prices.
Oh, yeah, the classic real estate example.
Right, exactly. So you feed it like 10 years of historical real estate data. It crunches millions of data points. And in your testing environment, I mean, it is just incredibly accurate. You deploy it feeling like an absolute genius.
Naturally.
But then the very first day it's out in the real world, it immediately starts pricing these like completely rundown shacks at $2 million just because it noticed they had, I don't know, three windows. And for some bizarre mathematical reason, it just vastly overvalued the window metric.
Yeah, it completely lost the plot.
Right. So why does this actually happen? It's because the machine didn't actually understand the concept of a house. It just found some lazy mathematical shortcut in that messy data you gave it.
Right. I mean, it optimized for the math, not the reality.
Yeah.
And honestly, that disconnect, that's exactly where most AI projects just completely fall apart.
And that is our mission for you today in this deep dive. We are taking a step back from all the theoretical hype and, we're popping the hood on artificial intelligence to see how these algorithms actually learn, and honestly, how easily they can learn the exact wrong things.
Yeah. And to do that, we're going through this massive, really comprehensive guide from AI MLOPS Masters. It's heavily focused on building actual machine learning projects with the real source code.
Which is so refreshing.
It is, which is absolutely the right approach, honestly, because, you know, whether you're prepping for a technical interview or you're just trying to wrap your head around this whole AI boom, or maybe you're just intensely curious about what actually happens when you type a prompt into a chat, window reading abstract theory is only going to get you so far.
Right, you hit a wall eventually.
Exactly. To really understand the engine, you have to look at the data, the code, and the actual, like, physical mechanics of how these systems are trained.
And don't worry, we are not going to drown you in a sea of jargon today. We're going to break down the actual engineering realities here.
Yeah, I'll do my best to synthesize the denser technical concept. My goal today is just to make sure you walk away understanding, you know, not just the what of these algorithms, but the why. Like, why do engineers have to make these specific choices when they're building this technology that is, let's face it, actively shaping our entire world right now?
Perfect. So before we can even talk about the code, we really have to recognize this fundamental shift in how computers are actually being programmed right now. Because for decades, programming was strictly about explicit manual rules, right? Like, if A happens, do B.
Right, classic conditional logic.
Exactly. But machine learning just throws that completely out the window in favor of data-driven pattern recognition. So, okay, let's unpack this real quick because understanding how your algorithm learns is really the only way to know which tool to pull from the shed.
That's a good way to put it.
So there are three main schools of thought here. First up is supervised learning. And to me, this basically feels like it's like studying for an exam with flashcards, but the correct answers are printed right there on the back.
Yeah, that's actually a highly accurate way to visualize it. Because in supervised learning, every single piece of input data you feed the model comes paired with the correct output, or what we in the industry call a label. So the model isn't just guessing in the dark.
Right. So if I want the machine to, say, recognize spam emails, I feed it a million emails, and each one literally has a tag on it saying spam or not spam. Like the answers are right on the back of the flashcard.
Exactly. So the model looks at an email, it makes a guess, and then it basically checks the back of the flashcard. It realizes, oh, I was wrong, and it slightly adjusts its internal math. And then it does this millions of times until it minimizes those prediction errors.
Just constant repetition.
Yeah, you see this constantly in systems designed to predict, you know, numerical values like your housing prices or categorical stuff like medical diagnoses.
Okay, so then we have the second school, which is unsupervised learning. Now, for this one, imagine you're handed this massive mixed pile of laundry, but there are no labels, no tags, no washing instructions, and you're just told, sort it.
Good luck.
Right. You'd probably start grouping things by color or maybe fabric type or something. You are independently finding hidden patterns.
Yeah, because in this case, the data is completely unlabeled. You aren't telling the algorithm what it's even looking at. You're basically forcing it to identify these hidden mathematical structures within raw data all on its own.
Which sounds kind of like magic, honestly.
It does, but a classic real-world application here is clustering. So imagine a business looking at like millions of totally random customer transactions. And an unsupervised algorithm like one called K-means, for example, it can group those customers into distinct segments for targeted marketing. And it does this without any human ever telling it what those segments were supposed to be in advance.
It just finds the natural groupings. That's wild. And then finally, we have the third school, reinforcement learning. This one feels exactly like training a dog with treats, honestly. You put the dog or, you know, the algorithm in an environment. It tries something through trial and error. And if it does the trick, it gets a reward. If it fails, it gets a penalty.
Yep. The agent learns optimal strategies entirely by chasing those rewards. I mean, it just wants to maximize its cumulative score over time. So when you see robotics or autonomous vehicles or that crazy game-playing AI that beats human champions at chess or Go, that is almost always reinforcement learning.
Okay, so we've got flashcards, sorting, laundry, and dog treats. But when you're actually sitting down at a keyboard to write the code, like, why does it matter so much which school you fall into?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, your school of learning dictates the exact architecture you need to build. I mean, if you have labeled data and you need to predict next month's sales, you're going to reach for a supervised algorithm like linear regression.
Makes sense.
But if you're doing unsupervised learning to sort that massive laundry pile of data, you need an algorithm built to calculate mathematical distance between data points, so you'd use something like K-means.
Okay, that makes sense. You have to match the engine to the vehicle. But here is where I kind of want to stop you and push back a little bit.
Sure, go for it.
So I totally get that choosing the right algorithm is important, but this MLOPS guide spends an almost obsessive amount of time talking about data pre-processing.
It really does.
Right. And isn't the entire selling point of modern artificial intelligence that it's, you know, incredibly smart? Like, if we have a state-of-the-art neural network, why can't it just figure out a messy spreadsheet on its own? Why are developers spending like 80% of their time just doing manual data janitor work?
I am so glad you brought this up, actually, because it is probably the most common misconception about AI today. The reality is that algorithms are incredibly fragile.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They are essentially these savants that only understand pure math. So if you throw muddy, disorganized, incomplete data into even the absolute best algorithm in the world, you just get highly optimized garbage back out. And there's a very specific mathematical reason for this, which we call the curse of dimensionality.
The curse of dimensionality. Okay, that sounds like a sci-fi movie. What is that actually doing to the data?
Okay, so think about it this way. If you're looking for a pattern on a standard 2D graph, you know, an X and Y axis, it's pretty easy to spot where the dots cluster.
Yeah, right? Sure.
Now, if you add a Z axis, making it a 3D cube, it gets a bit harder. But you can still visualize the pattern inside the box.
Right. I can picture like a cloud of dots floating inside a glass box.
Exactly. But in machine learning, every single feature or column in your spreadsheet is a completely new dimension. So if you feed an algorithm a data set with, say, 10,000 columns.
Whoa, 10,000.
Yeah, it happens all the time. You are basically asking the algorithm to find a pattern in a 10,000-dimensional hypercube. The mathematical space just becomes so impossibly vast that the data points spread out until they're infinitely far apart. The algorithm gets completely confused because everything just starts to look like random noise.
Okay, I see. So if I have a spreadsheet for housing prices, and I have a column for square footage, and then another for number of bedrooms, and another for number of bathrooms, having too many of those columns is actually actively harming the model's ability to learn.
Yes, because they're essentially telling the model the exact same thing over and over.
Yeah.
The house is big. You don't need three separate dimensions for that. And that is exactly why developers use dimensionality reduction techniques, like PCA, which stands for Principal Component Analysis.
So how does PCA actually fix that without just deleting important data? Because right, you don't want to lose the bedroom count, right?
Right. You don't just delete it. PCA mathematically squishes the data down by finding the highest lines of variance.
Mm.
So it looks at the square footage and the bedrooms and the bathrooms, realizes they all tend to rise and fall together in high correlation, and it mathematically merges them into a single brand new feature.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You might just internally call it size. So it simplifies the complexity of the data so the algorithm can actually process it efficiently, but without losing the core meaning of those original numbers.
So good feature engineering is basically the translation layer between the messy real world and the pristine math of the algorithm. Like, you have to scale the numbers, fix the missing values, and reduce the dimensions, or your model just completely fails before it even starts.
Precisely. And there's one more crucial pre-processing step here. Splitting the data. You absolutely have to divide your dataset into a training chunk and a testing chunk, because if you evaluate the model on the exact same data you used to train it, it's literally like giving a student the final exam questions the night before the test.
They didn't actually learn the concepts, they just memorized the answers.
Exactly. I mean, they will ace that specific test, but the second they face a question they haven't seen before in the real world, they will fail completely.
I love that analogy. Okay, so we've squished the spreadsheet, we've cleaned our data, but a spreadsheet is easy, right? It's just numbers. What happens when we want to process like a photograph of a cat or an audio file? Because that is just thousands of raw pixels or sound waves.
That's a whole different ballgame.
Right, and here's where it gets really interesting, because dealing with unstructured data requires a huge leap into deep learning and neural networks. And to make a neural network actually function, we have to introduce this concept of activation functions.
Yes, because without an activation function, a neural network, I don't care how many layers deep it is, it would essentially just collapse into a basic single linear model. It couldn't learn complex shapes or nuanced patterns at all.
So the way I've come to understand an activation function is I kind of think of it like a bouncer at a really exclusive club.
Okay, I like where this is going.
So the network has all these mathematical signals trying to move from one layer of neurons to the next. And the bouncer just stands at the door of the neuron and decides, is this signal strong enough to get in? Do you pass the threshold, or are you getting bounced?
That is a fantastic way to picture it, honestly. Yeah. The activation function decides whether a neuron should fire or not based purely on the input it receives. And historically, developers have used a few different types of bouncers, you know, each with their own specific mathematical rules.
Right. And the earliest ones were the sigmoid and ton functions.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And they're great in theory because they compress any input into a very smooth, predictable range. So sigmoid, for example, it always outputs a number between 0 and 1, which is perfect if you're trying to represent like a percentage or a probability.
But if they are so perfectly predictable, why don't we just use them for everything?
Because they suffer from a fatal flaw when you put them in really deep networks. It's called the vanishing gradient problem.
Wait, so if a signal keeps getting compressed between 0 and 1 over and over or across, say, 50 different layers, by the time it reaches the end, it's basically just a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. Does the network just like forget what it's even looking at?
You hit the nail on the head. That is exactly the math. Because when a network learns, it sends the signal backward through the layers to update its weights. This is what we call the gradient. But if you multiply small fractions together 50 times, the number becomes so microscopically tiny that it functionally just becomes 0.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so the earlier layers of the network, they receive no signal at all. They just stop learning entirely. The whole training process basically just grinds to a halt.
It's like playing a giant game of telephone, where everyone whispers quieter and quieter until the first person hears absolutely nothing. The signal literally vanishes.
So how did they fix the bouncer?
Well, the industry eventually moved to a new function called RELU, R-E-L-U, the rectified linear unit. And it fixes the problem by being computationally incredibly simple. Its rule is just this. If the input is negative, the output is exactly 0. It blocks it completely. But if the input is positive, it just passes that exact same value straight through.
Oh, I see. It doesn't squish it into a tiny fraction. So if the signal's a 5, it passes a 5. If it's 100, it passes 100.
Right. And because it doesn't mathematically squash those positive values, the signal stays strong all the way through the network, which just completely eliminates the vanishing gradient problem. So suddenly, deep neural networks can finally train efficiently. That's brilliant. But there is this fascinating kind of dark quirk about RELU, isn't there? Because it aggressively outputs 0 for any negative input. What happens if a neuron accidentally...
Exactly. Softmax is used at the final output layer, specifically when you're trying to categorize something into multiple distinct classes, because it takes the raw, messy, unconstrained scores produced by the network, and it elegantly normalizes them so that they turn into a neat set of probabilities that add up to exactly 100%.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so it can finally say, I am 80% sure this image is a cat, 15% sure it is a dog, and 5% sure it is a car.
Okay, so we've solved for pixels and images with ReLUs and deep neural networks, but images are essentially just grids of numbers anyway. What happens when you feed a neural network a sarcastic email or, you know, an angry tweet? Because a calculator cannot inherently read human emotion.
Absolutely. And that is exactly where NLP comes in, natural language processing. NLP is basically the translation layer. It takes the absolute messiness of human language, all our grammar and syntax and slang, and it forces it into mathematical representations that a machine can actually calculate.
But how does that actually work in practice? Like, how do you turn a word into math?
Well, there are a few ways. The most basic is the bag of words approach, which honestly, it literally just counts how many times specific words appear in a text, and it completely ignores grammar and word order.
That seems a bit too simple, right?
It is, which is why a much more advanced and heavily used method is TF-IDF, Term Frequency Inverse Document Frequency.
Okay, wait, break that down for me, because that sounds like a massive mouthful.
It is, I know, but the underlying mechanic is actually brilliant. It evaluates how mathematically important a word is to a specific document relative to an entire collection of documents.
So it's looking for the signal in the noise, basically.
Exactly. So let's say you're analyzing 10,000 customer support emails. Term frequency just counts how often a word appears in one specific email. But inverse document frequency looks at the whole batch of 10,000. So the word the might appear 50 times in one email, but because it also appears in all 10,000 emails, the math severely penalizes its weight. It isn't uniquely informative. But if the word refund appears heavily in one specific email and very rarely across the other 10,000, TF-IDF flags that as a highly mathematically significant feature for that specific text.
Oh, that makes total sense. Think about your own inbox, right? Every time an email from your boss correctly lands in your primary inbox, but a scam email promising you $1 million gets immediately routed to the trash, you are seeing TF-IDF and NLP in action.
Yep. It's everywhere.
It's how a company runs sentiment analysis on thousands of reviews to figure out if people are happy or angry, and they do it without a human ever having to read a single word.
It just completely automates an organization of human knowledge at scale. It's incredible.
Okay, so what does this all mean? We've cleaned our messy data, we've built our deep neural network with the right bouncers at the doors, we've translated human language into math, we run a final test, and the model proudly reports an accuracy score of 99%. Pack it up, we just deploy it into the real world, right?
See, this raises an important question about how we actually define success in machine learning. And honestly, it highlights one of the most dangerous traps an engineer can fall into. Accuracy can be a complete mathematical illusion.
Wait, how so? I mean, 99% accuracy is an A+ in literally any school in the world?
Well, let's look at a real-world scenario. Say you are building a model to detect fraudulent transactions for a massive bank. In reality, credit card fraud is incredibly rare. Out of 100 transactions, maybe 99 are perfectly normal, and only one is actual fraud. This is what we call an imbalanced data set.
Right, the vast majority of the data just points one way.
Exactly. Now, what if I write a completely dumb, broken algorithm that does absolutely zero analysis, and it simply guesses normal every single time, no matter what?
Oh, wow. Out of 100 transactions, it will guess normal 100 times. And because 99 of them actually were normal, it's going to be correct 99 times.
Exactly. It will proudly report a 99% accuracy score to the executives, but it completely failed to catch the one fraudulent transaction it was actually built to find.
That's terrifying.
Right. It is 99% accurate and 100% useless. That is exactly why relying solely on accuracy is a trap.
Mm-hmm.
We have to use more nuanced metrics to know if the machine actually learned anything of value.
The report card basically needs to be way more detailed.
Precisely. And this is where we look at precision and recall. Precision asks a very specific question. Of all the things the model flagged as positive, how many were actually positive?
Okay, so this is crucial for the spam filter. If your spam filter has low precision, it's generating false positives. It takes a vital email from your boss, flags it as spam, and throws it right in the trash. And you want to minimize false positives, because you'd obviously rather have a little bit of spam in your inbox than lose a critical email.
Exactly. Now, recall flips the perspective entirely, it asks. Of all the actual positive cases out there in the real world, how many did the model successfully find?
Ah, okay.
This is the metric that matters most for things like healthcare diagnosis. If you're scanning an MRI for a tumor, you cannot afford a false negative. You cannot send a sick patient home and tell them they are healthy. You need extremely high recall to ensure you catch every single subtle indicator, even if it means you accidentally flag a few healthy people for a secondary review.
Okay, so precision is about making sure you aren't crying wolf. And recall is about making absolutely sure no wolves slip past the fence in the dark.
That is exactly right. And because there's usually a mathematical trade-off between the two, I mean, you can rarely have perfect precision and perfect recall at the same time. Developers use something called the S1 score. It calculates the harmonic mean of both, giving you a single, much truer picture of the model's overall health.
And to visualize all this, developers use what the guide called a confusion matrix. It's like a literal four-square grid that shows you exactly where the model is getting confused. It shows how many true positives, true negatives, and false negatives it produced. It just puts the model's blind spots right on the table.
Yes. And developers validate those blind spots using a technique called cross-validation. So instead of just splitting the data into one training chunk and one testing chunk, cross-validation slices the data into multiple chunks, say five slices of a pie.
Okay.
It trains on four slices, tests on the fifth, and then it rotates. It repeats this process over and over, testing on a different slice every time, to absolutely guarantee the model isn't just memorizing the data.
Which brings us full circle back to the start of this entire conversation, really, because the overarching takeaway from the AI MLOPS Master's Guide is that the absolute best way to learn these concepts isn't to just listen to the theory. It is to get your hands on the keyboard. The source code projects outlined in their materials, using Python, TensorFlow, and Pandas, they take all these abstract concepts from the math of PCA to dying ReLUs to confusion matrices, and they just make them tangible. Building it yourself strips away the illusion of AI magic. It proves that underneath it all, it really is just data and math and code.
It is. But, you know, as we wrap up, I do want to leave you with one final thought to ponder. We just spent all this time talking about how machine learning fundamentally relies on historical data to predict the future. We perfectly optimize our weights, we balance our precision and recall, and we deploy the model.
Right.
But what happens when the future suddenly stops looking like the past?
Oh.
Yeah. A model is perfectly trained for the exact mathematical reality that existed the day it was trained. So when a massive global disruption happens or consumer behavior just shifts overnight, all that perfectly optimized math suddenly means nothing. The real challenge in machine learning isn't just building the model. It's recognizing when the rules of reality have changed faster than your data.
That is an incredible point. The model only knows what it has seen. So next time you see an AI make a prediction, just take a second to think about what is actually happening in the mathematical engine underneath it all. Keep questioning the data around you. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll see you next time.